I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. There's a famous photograph of Elizabeth Eckford taken in 1957, integrating Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. She is stoic, determined, carrying her school books surrounded by white people, including a 15-year-old teenager, Hazel Bryant, who is shouting at her. Our guest, Nancy Eisenberg, calls Hazel the ugly face of white trash. In her new book titled White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America, Eisenberg writes that poor whites have been looked down on since the arrival of the colonists. They were called waste people, and England was only too happy to be rid of them. We'll talk about that history and the present day and how poor whites have been depicted in popular culture with our guest. And she's the T. Harry Williams Professor of American History at Louisiana State University, joining us from the studios of WVTF. And Nancy Eisenberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Tell us about Hazel Bryant. And I have to say, I know that photograph so well. And I, of course, like I think a lot of other people, had been focusing on Elizabeth Eckford, the black teenager who integrated this high school. Who's Hazel Bryant?
Well, there's actually a very good book that sort of is called like Elizabeth and Hazel that looked at them. But what's so important about that photograph is there actually were three that were taken on that very same day, and they all wanted the same pose, the contrast between the two. And the reference you made to ugly face, well, that actually came out from the Times Literary Supplement in 1959, where it described what would be remembered from Little Rock were the ugly faces of rednecks, crackers, Tar Heels, and other poor white trash. So that moment, as we know, it was actually that event, the integration of Central High School, was the domestic story of the year. As we know, President Dwight D. Eisenhower got involved. He had to send in the troops to ensure integration. But there was a lot of emphasis on the contrast, the idea of poor whites contending with, you know, trying to protect, quote, their neighborhood, their identity that they saw would be a threat if their high school was integrated. And it's very political context. In Little Rock, there were three different schools. The school for the elite that was called the Cadillac High School was not integrated. There also was an all-black high school. So to sort of almost create more tension, that was the goal of Governor Orville Faubus. He had no problem in sort of, you know, ratcheting up the tension in Little Rock, and he claimed that there was going to be a race war, and he threatened that poor whites were going to arrive not only from Little Rock but from out of the state to do everything possible to stop the integration of this school. So we have, you know, when I teach Little Rock, I also put it in the context of the film To Kill a Mockingbird.
Sure.
Because the two go together. If we think about that story, which highlighted how a poor white girl, Mayella Yule, accuses a black man of raping her, and Mayella and her father embody poor white trash. She's shabbily attired. Her father's a bully, a scrawny man in overalls. And what most people probably forget about that movie or that novel is that Bob Yule's full name was Robert E. Lee Yule. And, of course, he's not an heir to one of the aristocratic families of the Old South. So what we get in the 50s, we begin to get this idea of insane bigotry. And that insane bigotry of racism is being attached to poor whites. And this is part of the problem. We know, yes, poor whites do not escape racism, but they certainly are not the only white people in the United States who embody certain racial ideas. But in the film, as we know, Atticus Finch is portrayed as the educated elite, if not eccentric, white who is, you know, not racially prejudiced.
And going back to Little Rock and going back to this incident of integration in 1957, do you think the intention was to create some kind of a class warfare between, or class clash, I guess, between poor whites and perhaps poor blacks?
Yeah, that was certainly the intention of Governor Orville Faubus. He thought it would stop integration. And everyone at the time was saying, oh, this was going to ruin his career. And he himself, this is what we also forget, he was looked on as white trash because he came from, quote, hillbilly stock. in the, you know, the Appalachian region. So he felt that Eisenhower and his assistants looked down on him. He also was written about in by journalists as being white trash. And one of the pictures that I include in my book is one of his relatives who is portrayed as, you know, this photograph of him who's cross-eyed, he's in overalls. And this is another theme I talk about. Mm. When we talk about trash and class, part of what gets used is that old English idea of pedigree. So the connection between Faubus and his relative emphasizes those old eugenic and even earlier ideas that class is something that's passed on, particularly when we're talking about white trash, because they're seen as a defective breed from one generation to the next. And that's a very convenient argument because it means you can't – charity isn't going to help them. Their fate, their destiny is already set.
Well, let's go back 400 years to when colonists were coming to this country. And as you write, poor people, it seemed that maybe let out of prisons or let out of cities in a way, coming to the country called expendable people or waste people. The idea that the colonists, I guess, with some money and perhaps some property, looked down on the people who were also brought to this country to do hard labor.
Right. We forget that North America, before it became the fabled city upon the hill, in the eyes of 16th century English promoters, adventurers, they saw it as a foul and weedy wilderness, a wasteland. And where they got that term from, and this is one of my other important things, is that class was connected to land. Because for half of our history, we were an agrarian nation. So the measure of success was the kind of land you lived on and whether you were even a property owner. For the English, the old world, they thought this was a perfect place to unload the idle poor. And who were they dumping in the new world? Convicts. And there was convict labor all the way up to the revolution. Irish rebels, whores, ex-soldiers, people in debt, children of beggars, and basically the indentured servant, which is a class that we tend to forget about. Mm. But they were an exploited form of labor because essentially people signed away their lives from anywhere from 7 to 9 years. And you have to remember when you're being sent to the New World in the 16th and 17th century, you're lucky if you're going to live that long. If you consider if you're like working in Virginia, working the fields with a hoe, it's physically demanding. There are numerous diseases. So most people who are being dumped into the New World aren't even going to live long enough to even think about becoming property owners.
We're talking to you from Philadelphia, from Pennsylvania. You talk about Benjamin Franklin's obsession with idleness. Also talking about Quaker families in Pennsylvania, Penn being the most obvious example, and their view of poor people or poor white people.
Yeah, I have a whole section which begins with Franklin. And then I also talk about Tom Paine, who, as we know, arrived in Philadelphia at the time of the Revolution and wrote the very important treatise, Common Sense. Right. But both of them, I mean, Tom Paine, first of all, had only been in the United States for 13 months. He was an Englishman in exile. Franklin, we have to remember, Americans are British subjects. And Franklin's way of looking at the colonies, looking at the world, looking at poverty, came from an English perspective. So yes, he sees idleness as, you know, as not a sin because he's not a religious man, but he does see it as one of the flaws of Englishmen. And that's what's interesting because at one point he claims that German immigrants work harder because somehow they didn't have handouts and support in Germany. So they had to work hard to survive. And that's kind of the dark side of Franklin's vision. Franklin was, despite the fact that he was a runaway servant, he had been an apprentice, he didn't come from an elite family, he really didn't have much sympathy for the poor as he acquired wealth and became such a famous man. And he promoted a theory that would be also adopted and promoted by Thomas Jefferson, the idea that what do you do with the poor? He felt that, you know, workhouses or almshouses were not the best solution. What the solution would be the size of the American continent. That the way – and then here he's echoing exactly what the British were saying, that if you can't make it in the colonies on the coast, you need to move west. And he was also envisioning the frontier – in two ways. One, we can say is a dumping ground again. He referred to the poor in the frontier as refuse, again, using waste metaphor. But he also, because he was a colonist and he was trying to sell the North American continent and make a argument about the imperial advantages of Pennsylvania and North America, he also argued that maybe the continent would be an advantage, that it would actually reduce class tension. Because of the size of the continent, people would move west, they'd spread apart, and that would produce what he referred to as a flattening out of the classes, what he called a happy mediocrity. Now, in theory, we could say, well, that's a nice idea, but of course it didn't play out that way because class and privilege moved west with the settlers. But his theory is really important because it's another point that I try to make is that class for Franklin was connected to reproduction. The English believed that demography or numbers determine the strength of a nation. And that's one of the things he was trying to argue at this time, is that the North American continent, we need to allow them to produce as many children as possible because that will be a source of strength. Here are future people to buy consumer goods from the British. But he also saw this as a way to compete with the Caribbean islands, who were producing sugar and more wealth for the British Empire. But what the North American continent offered would be people. That this somehow would be an asset, something that would contribute to the strength of the British Empire.
About a minute before our first break here, people obviously meaning poor whites who came from England. Compare that view to the slaves who were brought here to work on plantations and cut sugar cane, for instance.
Yeah. I mean, what we have to realize is that, you know, poor whites were the major labor source at the beginning. These indentured servants. But I do make the argument, and this is really important, there's a connection.
Sure.
When poor whites were sent over, they were treated as commodities. When they signed their indentured contract and they arrived in the New World, they also could be sold. And the other really important theme is that they laid the foundation for why slavery became the labor, you know, source for southern plantations, which really begins in places like Virginia, doesn't begin to take place until the end of the 1600s, the beginning of the 1700s. But this is, again, the idea that what they saw with indentured servants, they also realized a lot of indentured servants were children. They were orphan children. They were poor children. And that's the other thing we forget about our history, the exploitation of child labor. We didn't outlaw child labor in this country until 1919. So slavery relied on that same basic principle. How did you become a slave in Virginia? Well, a law was passed. You became a slave if your mother was a slave.
You know what, Nancy?
So again, it's about...
Yeah, hold on to that thought only because
okay.
We're up on a very short break.
Sorry.
That's all right, Nancy Eisenberg. We're talking about her new book. It's called White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Nancy Eisenberg. She's a professor of American history at Louisiana State University, author of several books, including a new one we're talking about called White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. And to join our conversation, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Nancy, there are all sorts of pejoratives. I mean, white trash is a pejorative in and of itself. Is that like the N-word in your mind?
Well, I'll let you know, I write about a very important survey that was taken by the sociologist Howard Odum, and this was during the Great Depression, where he interviewed all his colleagues, academics, people who wrote about race and class around the country. And Ira Reed, who is an African-American scholar who lived in Atlanta, wrote him because the question he asked, he said, what does this word mean to you? What did it mean when you were growing up? And Ira Reed wrote back and said that when he was growing up, as a black man, a black child, he said, you would never use the word white trash unless you expected to be called the N-word. So, yes, the word white trash, well into the 20th century, was very much seen to have the same negative, shameful notions that were associated with the racial slur. And I think we tend to forget about that because what I also write about is we move later into the 20th century. And this is, I mean, I even talk about it in the context of Andrew Jackson.
In fact, you call him our first white trash president.
Well, I talk about him being a cracker. And that's because of where he grew up. He grew up on the frontier of Tennessee. And the way in which he, again, is attacked by his enemies and for his style. He was known for slamming oaths, which meant he was, you know, he was more than willing to curse. And this was associated as a trait with crackers and squatters. But one of the things that we have kind of two traditions in this country. One is to denigrate the poor, to emphasize that their destiny is set and that, as I said, nothing can do to actually raise them up. It's impossible to assimilate them into normal society. And that means that, you know, people above them don't have to care. They write them off. And you see that over and over again in American history. The other tradition is sort of the hillbilly vaudeville tradition or the idea of the populist tradition. And that's where Jackson started when he began to represent not just the common man, but he was the man on the frontier, the cracker, that somehow the hardy experience of being on the frontier, making your own way. Davy Crockett, for example, was an advocate of squatter rights and a squatter. That somehow, that hardy, tough experience of the backwoodsman would somehow translate into making the American people stronger. But the problem with that whole myth is that once these civilization moves in, these people either have to be normalized, they have to become more sophisticated, more civilized, or what we find again, they need to move on. So, and the vaudeville tradition, this is, you know, also is loaded and heavy. We can connect it to Hee Haw, we can connect it to the Beverly Hillbillies, but there's always kind of a, you know, either a negative taint or you're laughing at the hillbilly rather than fully embracing the hillbilly.
And is it a view of a certain kind of Southerner? Is that how Americans tend to view so-called white trash?
And that's misleading, too. As I highlight, it's really a definition that comes from rural America. So in my book, I'm talking about why it's so important in the colonial period. I also talk about what when we look at the early Republic and the antebellum period with squatters and crackers. We're talking about the Old Northwest. We're talking as well as the Southern backcountry. The reason it becomes associated with the South has more to do with politics. And I place a great deal of emphasis on the sectional controversy, the rise of Abraham Lincoln's Republican Party when they began to attack slavery as a labor system. One of the things that they emphasized not only was slavery denigrating to the slaves themselves, but it also undermined the ability of a poor white man to experience social mobility. So that
because how are you going to compete with so-called free labor?
Right. And actually, there was some truth to that because the slave owners were an elite class, particularly if you owned a large number of slaves. They did dominate Southern politics, and they monopolized the land, and that's the biggest problem. Even as poor whites moved into places like Mississippi and Alabama, they were always at a disadvantage because large land speculators or large landholders always had the advantage in getting the best land, the most land, so the poor are always seen as being marginalized. And you have to realize how difficult farming is. Mm. You know, it's difficult to make a go of it. So if you have a small, lousy plot of land, what do you think is going to happen? You're going to find that you can't support your family. You're going to have to move on. So it was never an equal playing field on the frontier.
And I do want to get up to present day because there's much to talk about. But just since we're talking about the Civil War, this period in the middle of the 19th century, there was something called the 20 slave law. And we should know from our history that the people largely who fought for the Confederacy were not slave owners. They were poor people who probably didn't even own a slave.
Yeah, I mean, we know this about wars. Wars hurt poor people the most. And they are the ones, and this is true even when we go back to the American Revolution. You know, George Washington thought poor white men are the ones that have to be drafted as foot soldiers. There's always been a class bias. There was that class bias still in the Civil War. And you're right. If you were a slave owner, you got an exemption. A large portion of poor whites were substitutes. And we also know that there were high numbers of deserters because, as one scholar has written, which I think is a really good way to think about this, many poor white people who might have fought for the Confederacy thought of themselves as conditional Confederates. What hurt them the most is even if they did own some land, they were more vulnerable because they were leaving their farms unattended. They didn't have, because they were relying more on their labor of their family, that they would, you know, leave the army because they had to go home and protect their family, and they put their family first. So, yes, the Civil War had class politics was central. There was class tension. There were high desertion rates. And usually these were seen as playing out along in class lines, this whole idea that it was the rich man's war. This was one of the themes that circulated among Confederates. So this idea of thinking about class in the Civil War. Now, it doesn't mean that slavery, of course, was incredibly important, and those two become intimately intertwined in the politics of the mid-19th century.
Well, let's take a giant leap into the 1930s during the Depression, thinking of those amazing photographs by Dorothea Lange, James Agee, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, and the kind of pictures of what it was to be poor, landless in many ways, homeless in many ways in America. And, of course, many of those photographs of poor whites.
Yeah, the 30s is a really interesting period. And what I argue is that because it's the moment in our history when 20% of the population are out of work by 1932, it suddenly means that you can't just dismiss the poor and say someone's lazy or someone's idle. And it's one of the more intellectually interesting periods where not only photographers, but artists and intellectuals, academics, and a whole host of people begin to think about class in a much more sophisticated way. And you're right. I mean, one of the pictures that I have is important because, again, the 30s revived the idea of wasteland. Howard Odum, for example, discovered that the South had wasted so much land to erosion, the amount of land that was equivalent to both of the Carolinas and Georgia. And the image that for the period captured this idea of downward mobility, which is one of the dominant themes of the 30, was the gully, which is a very powerful, symbolic, metaphorical, and real material reference to the problems of the rural poor. And I talk a lot about the exploitation of poor white tenant farmers. And here's a statistics for you that we need to remember about how consistently this population occupied the American imagination and American politics. At the time of the American Revolution in Virginia, 40% of the population of white men were landless, and they also didn't own slaves. By the 1930s, it's also 40%, and the majority of those people who are landless are living in the South. Two-thirds are in the South and two-thirds are white. So part of the problem that we forget about is that agrarian societies do not promote social mobility. They're more static. At the time of the Revolution, for example, there was more social mobility in Great Britain than there was in the colonies because what promotes mobility is a commercial society. So that legacy of having this rather large population of poor, landless people is why this idea of white trash and why it ends up being identified with the South. But I would say it's not purely in the South because you also have similar terms for other rural areas outside of the South. For example, in New England, they were called swamp Yankees. You also can go to, when I talk about trailer trash, you also have poor rural areas in Wisconsin, Minnesota. So the idea of poor whites is really about the connection to rural society and the really negative connotations that we have about rural society.
Well, I'm also thinking about the lack of social mobility that we have today. I mean, I think there are a number of different reasons for that. I'm also thinking of Princeton University economist Angus Deaton, who got the Nobel Prize for economics last year. He and his wife, who's also an economist, Ann Case, did some amazing research finding that non-Hispanic whites ages 45 to 54 have a higher death rate based on things like overdoses and problems with drugs and alcohol, even suicide. What does that tell us then?
Yeah, I think, and that also ties into the older legacy, because in the antebellum period, white trash are called clay eaters and sandhillers. And they begin to be seen as clinical specimens. They are seen as, by that time, there's a great deal of emphasis on the yellow color of their skin, which is compared to tallow. Now, part of this is connected to the actual diseases they suffer from, which is hookworm and pellagra. But they also, again, that idea that we think of, or alcoholism is associated with them, but we think about the problem of the inequality of resources, and we tend to, because, you know, rural society can be put out of sight, we tend to not pay as much attention to it. And I think that's one of the problems. But their research, yes, I've read their articles, and I think it's we have to be reminded of this. We have to remember that the American dream has never been available to all people. It's never been, you know, people don't start on an equal playing field. And that gets back to the idea of the importance of children. Sociologists have found today, in 2015, 2016, that the most important predictor for being successful in this country are the wealth and privileges not only passed from your parents, but passed down from your ancestors. So that idea of pedigree, that idea that, and I think this is the idea that would, for Americans, would be the hardest to accept, is how much privilege is reproduced from parent to child. We don't think of that. When we want to think of class, we say, well, it's wealth or it's income or you work hard to get ahead. But in fact, it really does matter where you begin as a child and the kinds of privileges you give. I also talk about the importance of class geography, where you live. We live in class-segregated neighborhoods. And racially segregated neighborhoods. So that's also one of the barriers that I think we have to confront. We have to realize how much that is still with us.
And I do want to pick up on that. Just a quick reintroduction. That's Nancy Eisenberg. We're talking about her new book. It's called White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get James from Wilmington. He called us up. He's been waiting patiently on the line. James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a really fantastic topic, and I was struck. Hopefully I'm not moving the conversation backwards, but
That's
I was struck when your guest was talking about Thomas Paine, kind of identifying people as lazy and incapable of, you know, hard work, like, you know, an upper class person, like, you know, myself, say, would be capable of, you know, focus and discipline and hard work. And it seemed to go right in a straight line to me to welfare conversations that you have today, where there's all these coded words that people use to not use the N-word or something that seems out and out racist, but that there's a real correlation there where people are, you know, still pointing at another group and saying those people are lazy because they're, you know, just not capable of that. And I was wondering if there's been anything looking into that.
James, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to say it was actually Franklin who referred to them as being idle. Paine is more interesting because he doesn't really want to talk about class. He wants to attack the monarchy. And what's so interesting is the way he avoids class. He doesn't really engage in class issues until after the French Revolution, when he writes Agrarian Justice. And that's, I think, equally important, the way he doesn't want to address slavery. He doesn't want to He's more than willing to attack Native Americans for aligning with the British. So people have often heralded Paine as being the, you know, the supporter for laborers and artisans. In fact, those aren't the people he's advocating for. The one thing he does say, he's telling the elites, if they don't get organized and call for independence soon enough, there's going to be a social revolution, or what they refer to as social leveling. So that's part of what I'm trying to highlight about Paine. But you're right. One of the key things that I talk about, and this is why it persists, and this is also an 18th century idea, the idea that people will accept inequalities of wealth. Even they'll accept, if you're in the middle class, people being more wealthy who are above you, as long as you have someone else to look down on. Mm. This is what John Adams wrote in 1790. He said that, yes, Americans scramble to get ahead, but they need someone to disparage. And he wrote, there must be one indeed who the last and the lowest of the human species. And he said that this guy has to have a dog, so at least he has someone to look down upon. And what he says there echoes, and this is where, again, we see how class and race reinforce each other. This is exactly the same thing that Lyndon Johnson would say in the 1960s in explaining the racism of poor whites. He would say, if you can convince the lowest white man he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. Hell, give him somebody to look down on, and he'll empty his pockets for you. And that is really important. I mean,
and this is the Great Society, Lyndon Johnson, who obviously yes. cared about poor people.
Right. And what I also highlight about his Great Society is the two groups that he focused on were poor blacks in urban areas, and he focused on poor whites in Appalachia. And your caller is also exactly right about the way in which these kinds of attacks persist with our discussion about welfare, which is ridiculous, because think of all sorts of other classes who get privileges. We know about the middle class getting privileges through home ownership, through the federal government. We know corporations get incredible tax breaks. Why are we so angry that the poor should not get some support to help them rise up, to help them support themselves?
Well, we're taking another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Nancy Eisenberg. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and if you're just joining us, Nancy Eisenberg is our guest. She's got a new book. It's called White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. And she's a professor of American history at Louisiana State University. She's written a couple of other books, including Fallen Founder, The Life of Aaron Burr, Madison and Jefferson, Sex and Citizenship in Antebellum America. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I mean, Nancy, we struggle to talk about race in this country. Some conversations are more enlightening than others, but we don't talk a lot about class in this country. First of all, why do you think that is, and how do you think that creates a problem for us?
Well, I think that's where I highlight the importance of myth-making. Americans, as we know, often prefer the myth rather than the reality. It becomes part of the way we define ourselves as a people. And I begin the book by quoting Charles Murray, who presents that whole idea of an imaginary class-free America in his book Coming Apart. He basically said that a Gallup poll in 1963 was where Americans refused to say they were rich or poor. They said they were either middle class or working class. And he argued those refusals reflected a national conceit that has prevailed from the beginning of the nation. Americans didn't have classes, or to the extent that they did, Americans shouldn't act as if we did. Now, I wish that was true, but it really isn't true. And I think my book proves that throughout American history, what you do see, there are moments in political rhetoric when people want to diminish the importance of class, or they want to celebrate the idea of social mobility, or they want to imagine that we broke free from Great Britain and we left the class system behind. But there's also plenty of evidence, which I show, in which Americans are more than willing to talk about class and actually are very class conscious and very aware. And that's why we have all these names over the course of American history for denigrating poor whites, from offscourings to rubbish to rascals to refuse to bog trotters to rednecks to trailer trash. So I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that Americans were very aware of their class system, and just like the British, they wanted to police those boundaries between classes to ensure that the differences between the classes were well known, well marked, and well maintained.
I wonder, and this takes us up to present day, whether you see any connections between Occupy, Tea Party, even Bernie Sanders talking about things like income inequality, living in a rigged system that favors rich people or people with political connections, whether there is some kind of class conversation embedded in that.
Yeah, there's definitely a class conversation, and I've been asked to write op-eds about Trump and Bernie Sanders. And I think there's two problems. I think the 1% argument, it's not that it's invalid. It's important. I think it's really interesting that Trump, for example, is a real estate mogul, because even to this day, the super wealthy own most of the land in this country. It's not just power about Wall Street. But I also think the problem with just blaming the 1% is that we forget, well, how does the middle class, through their ideology, through shaming the poor, also contribute to the class system? Because class is an ideology. It is about the exercise of power. It is about privilege. And those things need to be addressed. But I think that the problem is that we just don't want to focus only on the 1%. They're part of a bigger picture. So I would like for Americans to sort of understand that the system is more complicated, instead of just saying that this is the problem, and if we control the 1%, our class system will disappear.
And you're saying it's not that simple. Let me get Mordecai from Mount Airy to join us on Radio Times. Mordecai, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks. Appreciate the show very much. How are you making a distinction between white trash and white working class? So the white working class person who earns more than a living wage, say the auto worker, the unionized worker. I mean, I think of the decline of unions in this country has caused a bigger split between the working class and what you're calling white trash. But what is the differentiation between people who can't support themselves, don't have a living wage, which I was assuming what you were calling white trash, and what's classically been called white working class, people who have a decent lifestyle?
Fair enough. Mordecai, thanks for the call. Nancy, sounds like you want to respond.
Yeah, you're making a very good point. I mean, this is part of the problem. You know, with language and slurs, often they can be thrown at a larger group. So, for example, Trump's followers have been called white trash. But, you know, Nate Silver has found that a lot of people voting for Trump come from a higher income group than people voting for Sanders or for Hillary Clinton. So it can be used as a slur, and sometimes it is thrown in the direction of working class. And there are also, throughout our history, we know that there are divisions in the working class itself. There were divisions between skilled and unskilled labor. We forget that the working class is not just about white men or people in labor unions, because women played a major role in factory work. They worked in textile labor all the way up until the early 20th century, women and children. So when we talk about the working class, we don't want to just focus and say that it's, you know, only people in unions. And I also think that can show the differences politically, because I think that most people who are in unions, we know they earn better wages. We know they have more health benefits. So they tend to be more supportive of the Democratic Party. Trump is clearly appealing to workers who are angry. He taps into the idea of global trade deals. His wall, I've suggested, is not only about keeping immigrants out and fear of class competition, but it's also about keeping jobs in. So I think there's part of what I'm trying to recover is both the political ideology, the way in which white trash has been used as a political weapon. But you're exactly right. There, we don't want to sort of when we try to figure out the class system, we have to be also, and this is what I do throughout my book, when I talk about the politics and the language, I then said, well, how did people really live at that moment? What were their social conditions at that particular time? I would say that white trash, we could say, well, these are people below the poverty line. But we also know, as sociologists have found, that even people who live above the poverty line will drop below the poverty line at least one, if not more, times in their life. So that boundary is much more fluid than we imagine. But I do think what the working class does have in common is that it's the fear of downward mobility, the lack of class stability. That's what I think working class America feels today, because you're right. The union system has been attacked and decimated, and that has undercut the security that they felt in the 1950s and the 1960s.
This intense sense of insecurity and, I guess, uncertainty about what the future holds. Let me get Regina from Princeton to join us on Radio Times. Regina, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I would like to. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I want to bring in this notion of class passing. So if you talk about the myth and you talk about the ways in which there's insecurity and it's much more fluid, then we would like to believe there's a lot of class passing, particularly when people get from the what you would call poor white trash are educated, and then they can kind of pretend or say, I'm from middle class, and they really are not. And it shows up in different ways because of the ways in which people get to practice or perform cues from what they believe is the upper class.
Oh, that's interesting, Regina. Nancy, go ahead.
No, I think that's a really important point, and has various, it plays out in various different ways. For example, when I'm talking about Lyndon Johnson, who came from the Hill Country, there are ways in which, you know, and he was seen when he elected that he had finally made it. But there are certain elements of Lyndon Johnson's persona that continue to mark him as white trash, you know, his drawl. He was even told, you know, minimize your drawl when you speak. And I think that there is that myth of assimilation and passing. But often people who fall into the nouveau riche or imagine they're moving up always get some reminder that somehow they don't know exactly the class rules for being the elite. The other point that the caller was making is, yes, Americans often when they're polled want to say, I'm in the middle class.
That's right.
Who's going to say they're in the lower class? You know, so they do want to imagine that they've moved up. But even in the 70s and 80s, what I found, there's a really interesting idea when the term redneck comes into vogue, is that people who had moved up into the middle class referred to themselves as upscale rednecks. And this is the other thing that I want to emphasize. When we talk about the hostility toward poor whites, it was often people who had moved up the ladder. Those are the people who were really hostile about welfare, even though their family might have benefited and they might have received advantages due to the New Deal. They're the ones who are the first to pull the ladder up and not want to extend aid and assistance to other poor whites who live in their neighborhood, in their country, in their state. So that's the other problem that we tend to forget about America, is that just because you yourself, just like Franklin, have come from a poorer background, it doesn't mean that you're automatically more sympathetic or more empathetic to helping other poor whites rise up. And they can often be the ones who say, well, I did it on my own, when often they didn't. And that's the other thing my book says. And there's no such thing as a self-made man. People need someone else. Franklin had patrons. And that's the other thing that we tend to acknowledge when we talk about privilege, is not only nepotism, but the idea of networking, the idea that that we have to acknowledge, or as I said, that the important role of what parents and the wealth and privileges they can give their children are really essential for deciding and determining who can succeed in this country. It's not just about talent, and it's certainly not just about merit.
Regina, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Nancy, you write about something called the Arkansas Strategy. Apparently, it goes back for perhaps more than a century here. But the idea that when you're running for office, and of course, this is political season, if you want to appeal to a certain segment of the population, you go bowling. And these are all the stereotypes, of course. You drink beer. You pose with a gun. Is that appealing to a certain segment of the white population?
Yeah, there's two really interesting things. You're referring to the story from 1840, the Arkansas Traveler. It becomes a popular song and a cartoon, but it had the elite politician canvassing in the backcountry. He comes upon a squatter sitting on a whiskey barrel who, when he asks for drink, the guy ignores him. And then to get this guy's attention, and it's a metaphor to get his vote, the politician has to bring himself down to the level of the common man. He has to jump off his horse, grab the squatter's fiddle, and show that he can play his kind of music. And in 1949, an Australian observer said the exact same thing. He said that America doesn't have a real democracy because we do tolerate huge disparities of wealth. What we have is a democracy of manners. And what he said is that what politicians have to do is to pretend to be like ordinary people. And we see it all the time. Iowa, politicians have to put on their plaid shirts and eat corn dogs.
Exactly.
You have to wear your, you know, Trump wearing his bubble cap. This idea that if you sound like you come from, you know, middle America, this is sort of why Sarah Palin was so popular, that somehow we're only caring about the theatrics, the performance, the display, as if politicians putting on this act during the campaign season somehow means that they really understand the condition of average Americans. Well, in fact, none of that matters. What really matters are their policies. But unfortunately, our politics for a long time have been about entertainment and not about substance, and we haven't escaped that. And I think it creates this masquerade where we pretend we have a democracy when we really don't.
And that's that's Nancy Eisenberg. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get George from Wayne to join our conversation. George, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning. First question is what ethnic groups you're associating with the term white trash? Are you, this term or other terms, are they spanning white ethnic groups from England and Ireland across the continent and including Jews? And then the next question is the role of racial politics in exploiting poor whites and poor people in particular, and whether you think racial politics has played a strong role in keeping having socialism never really having caught on in the U.S.
You know what, George, only for the sake of time, we're going to take your last question because we only have a minute or two before we have to say goodbye to our guests. But Nancy, can you take that?
I'm sorry. The second part of the question was
The role of he framed it in terms of socialism, but the idea of, I guess, pitting poor people against each other.
Yeah, this has been a common strategy. One of the key and the best examples of that are the, you know, Southern Democratic demagogues like James Vardaman, who I pay a lot of attention to. This is sort of at the turn of the century. And this idea that Vardaman, who also came from the middle class, he was a journalist, he went on the road, he ran for office, but he very much sort of used that idea of racial competition. And this is one of the most important themes of our democratic politics, too, the zero-sum game. The idea that if you give something to free blacks, you're detracting from this other group. And that's an old idea. Even Andrew Johnson sort of framed the Reconstruction period as a battle, that it was going to be, a class war between free blacks and poor whites. So that strategy has been exploited by politicians, and it proves to be, as we know, very effective because it's about, as I said, the who's going to get whatever resources the state has to offer and how are you going to distribute those resources. And that's, again, where race and class is intimately intertwined in our American history.
Well, you have given us a lot to think about and talk about. Nancy Eisenberg, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Well, thank you.
And the book is called White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. And Nancy Eisenberg is an American history professor at Louisiana State University. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.